Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
You have tuned in to Irish Illustrated Insider. It's Monday, May 10th. Tim Priester, Tim O'Malley, Pete Sampson joining you. Spring practice is wrapped up. A little bit of movement on the roster. Jordan Johnson, we mentioned that during last week's podcast as the news broke while we were recording. Dylan Gibbons has left the Notre Dame program with the intention of transferring somewhere in his home state of Florida. We'll see what happens there. Billboards. Prominent in Notre Dame's recruiting process, and Holden Stays verbally commits to Notre Dame publicly. That was something that we had known behind closed doors that had happened a while back. But let's start with the let's start with a roster movement. Just the impact of Jordan Johnson leaving, the impact of Dylan Gibbons leaving, if not in the starting lineup, certainly the depth along Notre Dame's offensive line.
I mean, I think it's worth noting that Dylan Gibbons leaving has a lot more impact on this year's roster than Jordan Johnson leaving, which is kind of a strange thing to say based on, you know, what you'd read on message boards or Twitter about who is the more impactful or interesting player. But I mean, Gibbons was kind of your Trevor Rulon, Mark Harrell offensive lineman, I think, on this year's roster. And now they're sort of one injury away on the interior from really having things in a bad spot. But, you know, Jordan Johnson, if we had seen him pressing for any first team reps, then I would feel differently about it. But that we never saw that in any of the spring clips or talking to the coaches during spring ball.
Funny you should mention that, Pete. There's a Monday musing out there about the transfers. And yeah, Jordan Johnson is the transfer that matters most in the future. But if you're looking at this year, I had Gibbons, we can say this, Tim, because he's not going to be previewed for counting down the Irish. I had Gibbons at 36 or 37. I had Jordan Johnson about 57, 58.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure where Johnson was, but he was lower than Gibbons. I think Gibbons ended up being 37th on our list. And he was, I mean, at least theoretically, he was the most versatile of the group because he was getting snaps at center. Maybe Andrew Kristofic becomes that guy because he got some snaps in the spring at center as well as guard. But Gibbons was, you know, in his fifth year in the program. And you know, I don't know how much he was going to play. He wasn't going to start. We thought when spring began that there was a possibility of that. But over the last couple of weeks of spring practice, he was getting most of his reps as a backup center, just as a safeguard for Notre Dame.
I thought Gibbons had developed pretty well as a run blocker. And he would, I thought he had always struggled a little bit as a pass blocker. I am surprised that whatever went on in the, you know, everybody has their postseason meeting with their position coach. He wouldn't have thought he would figure he was guaranteed a starting role exiting the spring. But I wouldn't think they would have said, "There's no, we're going in a different direction. You're not going to start either."
I just think it was the lack of, yeah. I think it was the lack of reps with the first team over the last couple of weeks. I mean, at least from what we saw, there were, and we get a cross section, but I would imagine that generally speaking, over those first 14 practices, that cross section is a pretty accurate indicator. And I never saw Gibbons get number one snaps over the last couple of weeks.
No, I feel like that was really kind of a first week clip.
Yeah.
Or Fisher and Spindler were really on the move there, before they bumped Kristofic inside. So, yeah, I mean, he would have been a valuable number two at multiple positions. You know, talent wise, he's not really in the same group as Spindler, Kristofic, certainly Patterson if it moves him inside. But I guess I was a little surprised just based on some of the things you guys had heard about where he was in the program. Like, it didn't seem like somebody who was itching to make a move. But if you're not getting any first team reps, that tells you what you needed to know. And if you want to play, he needed to go somewhere else.
And I'm sure, after waiting 4 years and figuring he was going to step into a starting guard role, he wanted to play. That makes sense too. I get it. You're it's not delusions of grandeur because you've already graduated. So give it a shot, right? I mean, if he was the sophomore that said, I'm going to go play somewhere else, maybe you won't. So that's the chance you have to take. But he graduated from Notre Dame, and now he could have a chance to play. I really feel like, I mean, Rocco Spindler probably is going to improve a lot over the next 4 months. But what if Rocco Spindler goes into Tallahassee and gets pushed around like he did in the Blue Gold game? Then you would want Dillon Gibbons in there, right?
Yeah, you would. I mean, I don't want to over, and we have a question in the second segment. Yeah. I don't want to overreact to one snap from the Blue Gold game against a guy 4 years older than Rocco Spindler. I mean, never saw that at any other point during the spring.
Gibbons is stronger though with 4 years in the program than a true.
There's no doubt.
It just would hold up that way.
It's just that, I mean, the upside, we talked about it earlier, that if you put the two on a scale, you know, certainly long-term Spindler offered you more, and Gibbons was a short-term situation for Notre Dame at best. So, yeah, I mean, it is interesting. And then Jordan Johnson, you had said earlier in the spring that, and I realize that any commentary on Jordan Johnson gets the blame game rolling again with regard to why he didn't develop, but they weren't. I mean, if we trust that the Notre Dame coaching staff has a pretty decent idea what they're doing at 43-8 in the last 4 years, their evaluation of where Jordan Johnson was as a player, and albeit in the second semester of his freshman year, but he wasn't making much of an impact behind a bunch of guys that have been in the program for a long time that don't move the needle for most fans because it's the same names of guys that haven't really emerged, but they're in a position to contribute strongly, and he just never earned that right at all this spring.
I think I would push back on that a little bit, like only in the sense that Keys, Lindsey, and Wilkins, I don't think are in some great position to contribute strongly the way Brian Kelly described it. So, but that only reinforces the fact how far Johnson was away from being a very high-level receiver at Notre Dame, because he's behind guys that Brian Kelly is really begging to take the next step. So if it's not like – this isn't Equanimeous St. Brown stuck behind Will Fuller. You know, Jordan Johnson is behind guys who have really struggled to make an impact or stay healthy, and he couldn't push the needle in that kind of a competitive sense. So – it's I think that Jordan Johnson's departure is unfortunate because it would be interesting to sort of see where he goes, but the fit there was kind of rough between player and program, I think.
Yeah, I think the fit is the problem. Other than that, he clearly would be a guy you'd rather have stay around and see if he can develop in the next year, right? I mean, No one's gonna. I just wanted to make sure we go on both sides of this. Jordan Johnson wasn't gonna play a major role this year unless something clicked in the summer, and he just went off in August. Because as Pete points out, there is a job for the taking, right? I mean, there's at least a backup number 4 or 5 role, and then say you get in the game and you play well, that's what gets you more playing time.
I think there's a starting job open.
Yeah, that's tough to. I mean, I guess Lindsey has to get hurt for that for me to happen, or I guess Austin not being back and Lindsey has to get hurt. That's a lot too, right?
I mean, it's like stuff that has happened each of the last 3 years.
That's true. But I don't know. I even think if you have Davis and Keys, I'm not sure if Johnson plays over either one of them.
I'm not sure either. Yeah. There's like, it's not a depth chart that's loaded.
No.
Look, if Sean, and I know this is apples and oranges, but if Sean Crawford can fight back from the amount of injuries that he had, certainly Braden Lindsey and Lawrence Keys, you know, are in a position to have a significant season. But I agree. I mean, I don't disagree with any of that. The fact that Jordan Johnson didn't earn a bigger niche this spring. I know most people want to blame the coaching staff for that. And as I've said before, never known a coaching staff that, you know, head coach is making $4 and $5 million a year and they're playing their favorites over guys that give them a better chance to win. It just, that's not real world college football.
I think it's more maybe, Don't you think, Tim, it's just you can see there's somebody somewhere could get something special out of Jordan Johnson, and you're not going to say somebody somewhere is getting something special out of Kendall Abdur-Rahman or Ogbonnafo is a guy you want on the team.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I don't think he was ever a five-star player, as we've said many times, but he's a legitimate four-star talent.
Right. Right.
Right. And maybe he will go somewhere, and maybe Dell Alexander, who gets a lot of the blame, maybe he didn't do a good job of developing Jordan Johnson. It was the second semester of his freshman year. So, I mean, he barely even had an opportunity to show himself, but he didn't know the playbook. He didn't know where he was going. He had academic issues. And again, I have to go back to everything immediately stemmed from academic issues right out of the gate. Well, and whether you agree with it, they're not going to play him in the fall. Pardon me?
He was kicked out of meetings. I mean, he was kicked out of meetings in the postseason. That's 4 months into your career. Yeah. That's 4 months, and you're playing for you're an undefeated team. Like, I mean, maybe it was after the Clemson game, but you're playing for a playoff spot. Why? You should be engaged in a meeting for Alabama in the wide receivers room, right?
Well, yes, you absolutely should be. And I go back to the Phil Jurkovec situation, and I said this many, many times. It's not one or the other. It's both are responsible for the situation. Notre Dame needed it. They had to find a way to coach up Jordan Johnson in a short period of time, and they didn't do it. Jordan Johnson didn't maximize his opportunities when he was given them on the practice field in the short amount of time that he was there. So it didn't work. We'll see where he ends up. Was somebody talking about him ending up at Alabama? What in the world are we talking about?
Last year, I believe one of his family members tweeted something at Alabama's receivers coach about it. So I think that may be it. I would think that going to like Missouri would be a better situation for somebody in that.
Holden Stays is a really good tight end. I really, really, really like him. I'm trying to think when I originally wrote that film review that we were waiting on for him to verbally commit, and he pushed it off until a few days ago and teamed with Eli Raridan. Now we know why Jack Nichols no longer a part of this recruiting class. That those two guys are Holden Stays, I think, has a world of potential. He's listed like 296 in the country by 24/7 Sports and the 15th best tight end in the country. I cannot possibly imagine 14 high school tight ends being better than Holden Stays. I think Eli Raridan has a long way to go physically, but I like a lot of things that I see about him, and I think that's a really nice duo that they have at tight end.
Yeah, I don't think we talked about Eli Raridan on the last podcast. I like tight ends who can effortlessly dunk a basketball. And I've not seen Stays do it. I'm assuming that he can, but I know Raridan can. So that's a really nice combination of guys. And I think that, we had some questions on this podcast a while ago about like Notre Dame's targeting of tight ends when Nickel was like the one guy. And I think we all sort of agreement, like, shouldn't tight end recruiting look a little bit more like offensive line recruiting? And even though Stays is sort of a low four-star and Raridan, I think it's like a high three. I like both of these guys a lot. These guys, to me, both sort of look more like what Notre Dame tight ends should look like coming into college.
You know who else does? Mitchell Evans.
Yeah, I did not think
that was going to be the case. He looks like he took Houston Griffith for a 3.5-yard, 4-yard ride on his first catch in the second half. And we say we like high 3-star and Eli Raridan and 4-star and Holden Stays. Well, I don't think I had Mitchell Evans any higher than the services had him. And now I do.
So no, it's difficult, especially when he played quarterback.
He had injury
issues prior to that. You know, Pete, you mentioned about Notre Dame tight end recruiting should look like Notre Dame offensive line recruiting. I agree. I said it the other way around when they took a verbal commitment from John Olmstead early, and frankly, when they took a verbal commitment early from Dylan Gibbons. I thought those were reaches at that stage of those respective recruiting cycles that surprised me at the time, and Jack Nichol did too. And Jack Nichol can be a fine college tight end, but it was too early for Notre Dame to take that verbal commitment. They corrected it. Obviously, Notre Dame doesn't like to do that to a young man. And Nickel understood it and moved on. But it's a really, really nice tight end duel that I think, you know, they're different. They're both kind of, I mean, Raritan's kind of, and again, I'm not making the exact comparison, but kind of the Tyler Eifert was a wide receiver in high school. I'm certainly not saying he's going to be a first round draft pick, but you know, I mean, a similarity in terms of body type and kind of part tight end, part wide receiver coming out of high school.
The only time to use this story, but when Pete said, "I like to see my tight ends easily dunk a basketball," you know who apparently the best dunker was other than Chase Claypool, like in the Brian Kelly era, was Tyler Eifert.
Yeah.
We mentioned something to Reese when he was playing. Like, Reese made some comment about being the best jump shooter on the team. And I offhandedly asked him, like, "Are you the best basketball player on the team?" He's like, no, that's Tyler. Like, he didn't want to step on anyone's toes and just get dunked on more by Eifert. So.
That's, I mean, the Eifert comparison is one, like, I think people in the group will make. You don't need to sort of lead them down the path. That's how they see Raritan.
I have heard no one from Notre Dame say that. Did somebody actually say that to you?
I've heard that, yes.
Good. All right. Then I'm going to pat myself on the back. Yeah.
Also, I have hit a certain age where I am now writing a recruiting story on somebody's whose dad I covered in Notre Dame, which is like really a little bit trippy.
I'm going to top that because his grandpa, Raritan's grandfather, was – when I first heard that, I mean, I naturally thought of the name Raritan when I heard it. But then when somebody said grandfather, was like, well, he can't be that old. Well, hell, I'm old enough to be in that range. So Scott Raritan, the former offensive line coach and grandfather of Eli Raritan, former offensive lineman from the great Nebraska teams and Notre Dame strength and conditioning coach at one point during Lou Holtz era. Yeah, but Eli Raritan, Holden Stays is Holden Stays. I that's a pretty physically developed guy. I think he needs to continue to strengthen his lower body to break through some of the leg tackles and ankle tackles that have gotten him, tripped him up at this point of his high school career. But I think Eli Raritan, there's a lot of development to be made there. There's a wide receiver in that tight end's body. Okay, we're going to wrap up segment one with that. Segment two coming up, burning up the boards, questions from our readers.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Welcome back to Burning Up the Boards. First question from Rex Hampton 8, and I concur with this notion and wonder, who is the genius behind the billboard idea?
Well, we've asked. It's been difficult to get a one-person answer. The recruiting staff came up with a really, really good idea with the billboards. Probably a little bit of an expensive one, but Notre Dame football can absorb that, of course. But I mean, let's just give credit to the recruiting staff. Chad Bowden, new to the recruiting staff. I don't know if it's specifically him, but we'll throw out his name as somebody that's new to the group. The pot of gold stuff from a few weeks ago was somewhat creative. Not as I don't think as creative as the billboards, or maybe as effective as the billboards. But I mean, good stuff. Notre Dame's trying to do some different things. Marcus Freeman's arrival has certainly added to the process, and this was a creative one that has gained a lot of attention across the country.
Well, I mean, Mike Elston is the new, again, recruiting coordinator. So, I mean, it's his shop. So I have to give some credit to him. And I mean, if you want to go up the food chain a little bit, and I believe it was probably a couple months ago, Brian Kelly, made the decision to flip Polian and Elston, and it was, it was to get some fresh ideas there. And I mean, you go back to doing the semi truck with Demetrius Robertson. I mean, they've done Pot of Gold in the past. That's, you know, not necessarily a new thing. But I think most of those have been sort of one-off recruiting things where you just try something new. Probably is not going to hit necessarily, but I do think this one, you know, it leverages Notre Dame's brand. It fits NIL stuff. It definitely has a "we're Notre Dame and you're not" vibe to it, which like Notre Dame likes to get out there too. So I give them a ton of credit for this one. You know, what success looks like off this, I don't know, but in some ways it might just be the successes that everybody's talking about it.
And it's cooler than the semi and 5,000 times cooler than the Pot of Gold. I'll throw that in too.
Yeah, and I would, Pete, I agree with you. I mean, I think if we in the media were to give anyone credit for this, it would be Elston. Elston wouldn't do that. It will be imitated in some.
It is a brilliant idea, Tim.
Yeah, no, it really is. It really is. It will be imitated in some form or fashion by others. But like Pete, like you said, I mean, we're Notre Dame and you're not. Notre Dame's in a position to use that philosophy, and it's really cool. They're really well done. Now, how much actual impact that will have on recruiting is very difficult to say, but it certainly plants a seed in some high populated areas where there are some good football players that are 15, 16, 17 years old that are noticing that now and could impact Notre Dame down the road.
As Jack said, does Paulus have one outside Penn High School anywhere nearby, or is there a?
Nah. If it gets you, as soon as you said Penn High School, I thought of Notre Dame's 15 home run first baseman from Penn High School.
Well, that does. There you go.
Yeah.
Stay home. I stayed home in Notre Dame.
Yes, exactly. Rutgers 33 hot. Heading into the spring, there was a belief that Blake Fisher's long-term home was as a guard. Has he shown enough at left tackle to change that opinion? If not, what else does he need to do to show that he can be a tackle from now on?
You keep playing tackle the way that he played it all spring. That's pretty much all he needs to do. You know, I don't want to trample all over Packy P's question coming up here, but Blake, I am a firm believer that Blake Fisher is starting at left tackle because he is the best left tackle on the team and has beaten out other left tackles who are probably pretty good.
Yeah, that's going to have to include Jarrett Patterson, which makes for some awkwardness in August, because it might come down for Jarrett Patterson. And Tim, I know you've talked about this enough, that he is just much better at guard than Josh Lugg would be or Blake Fisher would be, and they are really good at tackle. And you have to put your best five out there in the five positions, right? That's we all think Josh Lugg's better tackle than guard. Clearly, the staff really likes Blake Fisher at tackle. Now, Patterson wasn't there to compete against him, but it's what you want to get your combination of those best three. I know Patterson could be a better guard. Well, I shouldn't say it. No, I've never seen him do it. I believe Patterson would be a better guard than Lugg.
Yeah, yes, no, I agree with that. And I was the one that kept saying Blake Fisher's a guard. Blake Fisher's a guard. I'm sure he could play guard very well. But I was wrong about left tackle. He was, and I realize he hasn't passed the final test in spring practice. It's not against live competition and an opponent. But I personally feel like I've seen enough to be a believer at left tackle. Could Jarrett Patterson play left tackle that well? Maybe, probably, maybe based upon what Notre Dame saw of him when he came in as a true freshman. But, man, he's good out there. He's so balanced. He doesn't lunge. He's got the quickness to protect the edge. Again, we haven't seen live stuff against an opponent, but I was wrong about that. I thought, for me personally, and apparently for Notre Dame, he passed all the tests this spring. I have a hard time, as good as Jarrett Patterson is, and Jarrett Patterson's going to be probably a top 100 pick when he enters the NFL draft, whenever that is. And I'm sure that he could play left tackle very well, but I know he'll play. And no, I haven't seen him play guard, Tim, but I have seen him play tackle in practice and center. And there's no reason in the world why he can't be a great guard. That may not be exactly what Jarrett Patterson wants to hear, But in terms of what's best for the entire offensive line, I think Blake Fisher has proven that he should be Notre Dame's left tackle.
Next related note from Packy P. Is it more good news that Fisher and Spindler may start, or more disappointing that others who have been on the program aren't ready?
I think it's more Fisher and Spindler. I mean, look, we knew they were good football players coming out of high school. The expectation seldom is that they're going to step into the starting lineup as true freshmen. But, you also have to take in consideration that, I mean, like a guy like Andrew Krzysztofik, he's a redshirt sophomore. I mean, Aaron Banks wasn't ready, or because of the depth, didn't start as a redshirt sophomore. Now, an injury precipitated that midway through his third year in the program. But a lot of times, only the elite offensive linemen are in a position generally to start as a redshirt sophomore, junior, and senior. Eichenberg did it. Hainsey, of course, was a starter right from the beginning. But to me, it's Fisher, Spindler are unique players with a tremendous upside. We knew they had a tremendous upside. They're just showing it sooner than anticipated.
I would distinguish between Fisher and Spindler here. I think that Fisher starting says more about Fisher than it does about the other guys on the roster. And I think Spindler starting would say more about the other guys on the roster than it would about Spindler. Not that I'm diminishing how good Rocco Spindler can be. I just think that the guy, they should have had more options at guard. And I get the sense that at guard, they're like, they would love it if an older guy grabbed hold of that position, and it's just not happening. Whereas Fisher, I think, has just been like, holy crap, this guy is unbelievable. Whereas Spindler may ultimately win it, and that may have more to do with Quinn Carroll and Krzysztofik and some of the older guys who just haven't grabbed hold of the spot.
Yeah. Carroll, you would think, even with that injury, could be threatening more to be Notre Dame's starting guard in year number three, considering how he was looked at when he came in as a freshman, right? In the early returns, they were super early returns we got on him before his injury. So Dylan Gibbons, I mean, he obviously had every chance to win it, right? So that probably tells you he's leaving. So that tells you all you need to know, I think. Tim, you made a good point about Eichenberg. He took until this point Quinn Carroll and Andrew Krzysztofik's point in his career to start. Now, I think he was clearly going to be a good starter then. We wouldn't have been questioning that Eichenberg could hold up at all. Going into that 2018 season, we had heard really good things about him already from Heastand and from Kelly. You make a good point. Like Josh Lugg, he was going against a lot better players, but Josh Lugg didn't win a job until his junior year only because Robert Hainsey got hurt. He would have been a first-time starter last year if Hainsey never hurt his ankle. Tosh Baker. People are disappointed that Tosh Baker didn't grab a job. Like Liam Eichenberg was nowhere near a job at Tosh Baker's age. He was moved away from Hainsey and Kramer. So it does take some time.
No, it does. And Pete, I can appreciate the distinction that you made between Fisher and Spindler. I agree with that. Maybe I'm thinking that I at one time predicted that Spindler would had a chance to come in and start as a true freshman. And you're right. I mean, I think there's a cap on how good Gibbons could be as a redshirt senior. I don't know. I mean, I have a hard time distinguishing between whether, if Carroll hadn't suffered that injury, would he be ready to go full go and compete at his best this spring? I don't know that. But Spindler's better than him right now, and there just isn't. There isn't much doubt about that. And I think any advantage that Gibbons may have had by being, 4 years older than Spindler was mitigated by the fact that Spindler is going to be a great offensive guard that's going to play in the NFL.
Yeah, that's fair.
Question from we're going to do back-to-back questions from Denver Maximus. The first one is
congratulations, Denver Maximus.
Yeah. I don't generally like to do that, but I missed a question and I wanted to add it. So there we go. As talented as Spindler is and will be, how concerned are you that he may not have the strength or stamina as a true freshman to hold up against stronger college ready players? I still have visions of Heinisch pushing him easily into the backfield.
I mean, in Congress with what I just said, they're usually not ready to compete at that age. So I do have concerns about that when they play good defensive lines, right?
I'd say very concerned. But I mean, that's the thing. Like, you can't fast forward strength training. It takes a long time. It takes more than 9 months to be, I think, college ready to play on the interior. I think it's a man's world down there, but we're talking about start one of probably 52 starts. Is that right? If my math is correct on Rocco Spindler.
I think it's 56 these days, Pete. They go to the playoffs and keep going.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. I retract that. But he will just get better and better and better and better. But you have to allow for the fact that he's starting at the bottom and then he's going to climb and climb and climb in the strength room. But that's, you know, being ready on game one to be a very, very good interior offensive lineman as a true freshman is just, that's a big, big ask.
You know, I think knowing what we know about Rocco Spindler, 3 months will not close the gap completely, but it will take a chunk out of that gap. I believe that because he is that dedicated to the craft and will cut the disadvantage there. I also think, you know, let's not overreact to one snap because line play is leverage. And when a guy that's 4 years older gets that leverage out of the gate, there's really no recovering on that particular snap of the football. Once you're reeling and you've got a guy that's 4 years older than you and strong as hell, you're not going to be able to recover on that snap. But will there be times when he's going up against a senior or a fifth-year senior where he's at a little bit of a strength disadvantage? There's no doubt about that.
Well, I think that he'll run into Kurt Heinisch-type players who are like, you know, the old YMCA gym rat guy where, you know, doesn't look super athletic but just knows how to use technique and hand placement and trick you. Like Rocco Spindler is going to get tricked in the fall. But those are great learning experiences if you can play through them as an offense.
Well, think about the tricks. If those two freshmen line up next to each other, I mean, they're going to get schemed out of situations. There's just no doubt about it. They'll be in situations where they haven't seen them before, plus the disadvantage strength-wise where they will get schemed into making mistakes. But, hey, I truly believe that those are two of Notre Dame's five best offensive linemen at this point, and it is what it is. You have to live with it. Second question from Denver Maximus, getting away from Spindler and the offensive line and Fisher. With a ton of hype surrounding Cam Hart at cornerback, where does that leave Tariq Bracey? Any thoughts on what the secondary may look like?
And I think Tariq Bracey's in a good position still. I like Cam Hart too, but I think Tariq Bracey is in fine position to keep competing for that spot. I know they need four, right?
Well, and at the end, and I mean, and they need, you know, we don't know who the nickel is, and Bracey has a lot of, you know, a ton of coverage experience. So whether those three have some form of rotation, or, you know, you just need a sub or you're in nickel, you're in dime, Tariq Bracey should still play a lot of football for Notre Dame this year, even if Cam Hart is the starting safety opposite Clarence Lewis.
I agree. You need four corners to feel good about yourself in terms of your overall depth going into the season. And I mean, Tariq Bracey is probably number three at the moment. Like you want Bracey and Henderson to give you something. So I think there's a ton of work for Tariq Bracey this season, even if he's not one of the top two corners.
And Bracey should really take it. Yeah, I know it's early. We haven't played 2021 yet, but he should really take advantage of 2022. If he has a strong year and as he continues to try to get stronger physically, he's in a position that where he would really benefit by taking advantage of that extra year.
It's a position that will be, there's still concerns about it, but looking into it today is much different than last year at this time or last August, where you're like, oh, the cornerback position is going to be rough. Now, we didn't know Clarence Lewis would play well. So that was a pleasant surprise. But right. I like, as Pete mentioning Henderson, I mean, I like those four guys. It's, I think I said last week, they have a 2 and 3 threes. Not a 1, a 2, a 3, and a 4, but yeah. I do like the 3 threes.
I mean, just like snap counts last year, Bracey was the third most on corners, and he was at 288. But then to get to the fourth corner, who was Cam Hart, he was at 6. So, you know, you're trying to find 350 snaps between probably your third and your fourth corner, right?
Yeah, Hart was dealing with some – he was dealing with some shoulder issues too, but last year. But, yeah, I mean, you need those guys. It's a long season. You need depth. You need nickel. You need dime. He has a very good chance of being on the field quite a bit, even if he is not an actual starter in the base defense.
Buck Dancer, any word if Notre Dame is considering making a transfer portal move, or are they ready to roll with what they have?
I don't think they're ready to roll what they have. I think that that's something that they continue to mine as a possibility. Safety. I don't know where you're going to find an offensive lineman that's going to come in without the virtual guarantee of starting. But that's kind of the situation that they're in, unless there's a real veteran out there that could bump, you know, maybe Spindler from the lineup. But and wide receiver, you don't close the door until the transfer portal is over or is empty or just can't help you at those positions.
Yeah,
I mean, especially with the transfer rules changing, you are always open to this idea at all times at every position. That's just the mentality that I think is smart to have moving forward. And I think that's the mentality Notre Dame will have moving forward.
Question from Basney BMW regarding Sebo Flemister. What's the situation with Sebo moving forward? Play on words there with the Basney is a local BMW dealership here, for those not familiar with it in South Bend.
You know, I feel like people are jumping the gun a little bit here. If he's a Class B misdemeanor, I mean, we can all kind of guess why he left the scene of an accident at 3 a.m. on a weekend. But technically, he's going to be a Class B misdemeanor. I think Sebo's punishment is similar to what other guys have had, and that's going to be some extra early mornings with Matt Bayless as interns, and then some time with Mr. Bayless later on in the day, maybe, and maybe some time with somebody else later on that evening, because Sebo's life will be difficult for doing that. But you want me to name all the guys that never miss a play for getting arrested or not? It's already on the board. Do I need to do that?
No, I think you should, because the perception is that he's definitely going to be suspended. And go ahead and list the names of guys that have...
I think he might have been suspended if he was arrested for that DUI and causing an accident or something like that. But look, Tavon Coney, Kevin Stepperson, Dexter Williams didn't miss a play of the Texas game. Kevin Stepperson was a freshman, and they were arrested with possession of a handgun and marijuana 2 weeks before the season started, Now, Max Redfield was kicked off the team, but Max Redfield was kicked off the team for 1,000 incidents before that. You don't kick him off the team for that. Javon McKinley made his career debut after punching campus police officers getting arrested. That's when he made his debut, his senior year after that. That happened in the spring. Michael Floyd had 3 alcohol arrests and didn't miss a play. Now, he got suspended for the spring, which was kind of like a bonus for him. What are we looking at here? This is Tommy Rees and Carlo Calabrese got suspended because there was assault on an officer.
Yeah.
Why would Sebo Flemister get suspended when none of these guys got suspended for, I mean, I'm not going to judge what they've done by saying worse or better, but a Class B misdemeanor is not the same as possession of a handgun and weed while being high driving.
I've got a bunch of old acquaintances from the teams from the late 80s that are shaking their head, like, you know, Michael Stonebreaker shaking his head. He missed the whole season.
Well, he got his accident got him too. I mean, that.
Yeah, no, I know. But you know what I'm saying. I mean, the times have changed, and they're a lot more lenient in terms of punishments and things like that. But Sebo will
he's not going to have an easy time of it when he's back doing stuff.
But he'll be in uniform for the opener at Florida State. We're quite certain. Question from Irish Gambler. Is there a position on defense that you expect to be more or less productive because of Marcus Freeman's defensive philosophy?
Will linebacker, but I don't know if that's a philosophy as much as like those guys are getting older, new voice, that, but I'm not sure there's another position on the defense that I would point to and be like, that position is going to have a renaissance because of a new system or a new coordinator.
This doesn't have much to do with his philosophy necessarily, just that they're deeper, hopefully, or and maybe it might be how Freeman uses him. I mean, I think Kyle Hamilton will have a much more productive year, but I guess we talked about that already. It's his, he was injured in game number 1.5, right? Or second half, first game number 1. Yeah. So that's probably why he wasn't picking off passes and scoring left and right like we thought he might.
Yeah, I think, you know, anytime you have a defensive philosophy that's a lot more aggressive and attacking the line of scrimmage, you pop things open for other defensive players. So while the defensive end position, I think just in pure pass rush alone and base defense is still a bit of a concern, I think Marcus Freeman can create some sacks for the defensive ends, which in turn, you know, like sometimes you see a defensive tackle having a higher sack total. Is it because he's just flat out beating somebody, or is it schemed because the offensive line and pass pro has to deal with, you know, somebody coming from the second or third level? I you know, just off the top of my head, that's something that I would suggest, that I think there are some schemes there that can create sack opportunities for guys that wouldn't, you know, normally have those sack opportunities in a base defense.
Tim, I think you wrote about this or were writing about it. Notre Dame, their corners and safeties will probably have more chances of interceptions just by the way they're playing too, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Cincinnati had 16 interceptions in each of the last 2 years, and Mike Mickens got credit for it in 2019. Well, they had 16 interceptions in 14 games in 2019. Then Cincinnati had 16 interceptions in 10 games last year. So
Notre Dame's leader had one pick last year. It's amazing.
Yeah. So I think the scheme creates opportunities all over the place. It creates opportunities for big plays for the opponent. It creates sack opportunities for a variety of players on defense, and it creates interception opportunities on the back end of the defense as well.
Next from Hayden Adams Z, what was your favorite overreaction from spring practice by the media or fan base? And what's the key storyline you felt went under the radar but will rear its head in the fall?
You know, one that I think, I mean, you know, Jordan Johnson's an overreaction for a guy that hasn't done anything yet. Declaring Lindsey Keys and Davis no good is an overreaction based upon the past. I think the Spindler-Heinisch snap that everybody's talking about is a bit of an overreaction, but I get it. And then what I said about being able to scheme against a couple of freshman offensive linemen, you can a good defensive coordinator can put them in some difficult situations.
Tyler Buckner starting at quarterback would be
I thought that would be blown out of proportion a little bit more than it was. That's why I didn't mention it.
You were kind of disappointed by the fan base on that.
Yeah,
like,
I thought.
Come on, guys.
I was gonna jump on that one. Actually, I was gonna bandwagon. Yeah, let's do it.
I mean, that would definitely be one. You know, I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know. It was kind of an overreaction light spring practice.
Yeah, maybe on the flip side of that, like, you know, like, and I'm guilty of this. I mean, Tagovailoa-Mosa, I've already declared him a legit big end, and he's going to do great there rushing the passer based upon what we saw in the spring. That might be a little bit of an overreaction. He still has to prove that against live competition.
I think I could do an overreaction that will also rear its ugly head in the fall. Like, if you're saying Jordan Johnson, then everybody's overreacting because Jordan Johnson probably wasn't going to start. But if you're saying Jordan Johnson, not again, then you could say that Notre Dame's leading receiver from 2017, 18, 19, and 20 has not done anything at the college level. their highest recruited receiver for the last four classes has not done anything at the college level. So that is more along the lines of not again with Jordan Johnson rather than just Jordan Johnson. So that would be rearing its ugly head, I guess.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, it's fair. I mean, it's fair to bring up. I don't know if it has to be a topic every single day of our lives throughout spring and summer, but
that could come back though. You know what I mean? Like Jordan Johnson might not have mattered at all in 2021, but somebody has to matter from that group.
Yeah. Yeah. Xavier Watts has to matter.
Right. Right.
I mean, we didn't mention him earlier when we were talking about this, but they really need to develop the hell out of Xavier Watts. They really do. I mean, come on. You better, if you're going to, if the Jordan Johnson thing fizzled, you better do that. Or Deion Colsey comes in and does something right away. I think we have a question about him later. We'll move on from that. From Jim Booney, CRS, how's Kevin Austin's recovery from foot surgery coming along? It's ankle, right, Pete? Is that correct?
Foot.
It is foot. Okay.
Yeah, Kyle Hamilton was ankle.
Okay, that's right. That's right.
This would
of course
potentially fall under the category of what's the key storyline you felt went under the radar, but will rear its head in the ugly fall is Kevin Austin's left foot. Because I don't know how I got into a Twitter discussion, or maybe it was in the comments of a story that I wrote, but I just have a hard time seeing Notre Dame's offense being dynamic if Kevin Austin isn't full strength. And there are people that will really want to believe that they'll be fine at receiver without him. I just don't feel that way. I think it has to be Austin, Tyree, Kyron Williams, Michael Mayer, with Avery Davis as like the fifth guy for Notre Dame to really have a dynamic offense. So that I don't have an update on where his foot is.
Well, he got on the field at the end of spring practice. So progress is being made. They wouldn't put him out there if he wasn't ready to do that. He had started a running process. I totally agree with you. I mean, that's why we had this discussion, I think, a week ago when Brian Kelly responded to your question about from good to great. How do they get to good to great? I don't think they can do that without Kevin Austin. And having said that, if Kevin Austin is healed and doesn't have a setback, I think he'll be a difference maker for them.
Yes.
I agree. And Pete, go back to that Twitter or message board and let them know that, how's this logic? Your best wide receiver is Kevin Austin. Your other wide receivers, along with him, are unproven. Why would you think removing your best wide receiver won't matter? It will matter. They need Kevin Austin out there for a group of unproven receivers. But Tim, you make a great point. If he's back on the field running in late April, that's 4 months after surgery, this is one of those injuries where when you don't have surgery, they do kind of rush you back because you're technically healthy. And I don't mean Notre Dame, I mean football. Like, if you break the fifth metatarsal, like, believe me, I had this conversation all summer with doctors trying to figure out what Kevin Austin would be like in the season. You're not supposed to come back and play football in those 6 weeks. Like, you're supposed to be like, okay, hey, congratulations. Now go live your life again. They go out and they play football, which is really, really more stressful than going out and living your life after having that injury. So the surgery, supposedly the surgery is what everyone needs and doesn't get, because surgery means no football season for you. But I guess the surgery is what you are supposed to get with this injury. That's probably the best news for Kevin Austin. And they wouldn't have run him out there for the heck of it in April because there was no game coming up.
Right. And I agree that Tyree and Williams on the field together is going to happen because Tyree has to be. They're both good receivers. I mean, Williams is probably even a better receiver than Tyree. Lindsey looked pretty darn good in the spring. I mean, he looked stronger to me. There's no reason why he can't, again, stay healthy and make an impact. He's done that already, not on a grand scale, but he has done that. And kind of getting back to an overreaction from Hayden Adams Z, there might be an overreaction to Lawrence Keys from the spring, right? I mean, I'm not sure that he's a consistently impactful player from week to week.
Yeah, I think all those receivers need one more to help the trickle down like we talked about last week.
Yeah.
Speaking of receivers again, Jay Jude, Deon Colsey will arrive this summer as the tallest wide receiver on the roster. Do you think he will carve out a red zone package role?
My first reaction would be Mayer, Takkus, Evans. You know, I mean, I know they aren't wide receivers or tight ends, but, you know, Takkus is 6'6". Mayer's just an absolute beast. And Evans looked pretty good. Colsey's a bigger receiver. Yeah. You know, I mean, maybe he can, but there are those out there that don't think that Brian Kelly will ever play a true freshman receiver. So I'm not going to say a whole lot about Deon Colsey right now.
I mean, the question here is, like, who is your boundary receiver by himself when it's third and goal at the 5? And I would put Michael Mayer over there.
Right.
Yeah, or Kevin Austin, too, if he proves he can do it. Right. Again. But Michael Mayer first. You're right. No, I agree with you. Michael Mayer is the one to put out there, but Austin's another option. Do I think Deon Colsey will carve out a red zone package role as a freshman? No.
Yeah.
But it's an intriguing question, and I think I asked it last, as soon as they lost Jordan Johnson. I was like, well, somebody has to show up, and he is the unique size compared to everybody else. Like, you mentioned Lawrence Keys has to hold up and all these guys. I mean, Avery Davis and Lawrence Keys aren't your red zone package guys, right? And Braden Lindsey.
No, but I bet Holden Stays is in the future.
Yeah, no, that's true.
His catch radius is really, really massive. Question from Irish from A2. In what ways, if any, do you think the 2021 team will be noticeably better than a 2020 team? I know where it needs to get a lot better.
Offensively.
The rush defense was good last year. I think it'll be. I mean, the rush defense was very good last year. I think it'll be. I think the rush is going to be great. They could have a great run D this year. They're so deep. You could lose any one player. You still have a great run D. Just be like, yeah, it'll be fine. They'll have a great run D. It would hurt with Heinisch because he's a 5th-year senior, and as Pete mentioned, I mean, he's just going to be a anchor in there for 35 plays. But you could really lose any player, couldn't you? From that defensive front.
I mean, yeah, I think they can afford to have somebody get hurt.
Yeah. You don't want to, but
I don't think Jonathan Dorr is going to miss 5 out of 9 again.
No. If he does, he won't get a chance to get to number 10.
Yeah, but my point of where they need to improve, they're 84th in the country in touchdown percentage in the red zone. I have confidence that Tommy Rees, being a smart offensive mind, will come up with some solutions to that, which ties into Jay Jude's question about Colsey or whoever is targeted in the red zone. But they have to get better down there. If you do that, you know, I mean, think about if Notre Dame, and I know it's a big if because they were 84th in touchdown percentage in a red zone, but we look at Notre Dame's offense a lot differently if they are not so atypically poor last year in the red zone in terms of scoring touchdowns. And is that, I mean, that's, you know, Tommy Rees has to shoulder a lot of the blame there. You've got a veteran offensive line. You know, you've got to be better there. And I think that they will be.
Sounds like Ian Book, according to Brian Kelly, without saying his name, could shoulder a lot of that blame though too, right?
Being yeah.
As if the way he mentioned, just got the quarterback's got to be decisive and those
decisive. Things. Yeah. And I think Jack Cohn will be decisive. When it comes to that, yeah, that was a good point because that was kind of mentioned in passing. But if you listen to what was being said,
yeah,
the 4th round draft pick had trouble finding things quickly and decisively in the red zone.
So you're saying Buckner should start, Tim, right? That's what we're taking away from this. There's good. Go to the freshman to find it.
I would not be surprised if, and I know this is kind of a cliche, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was a red zone package for Tyler Buckner. Now I'd like to see. I would like for Jack Cohn to have been disproven as the guy in the red zone before you go ahead and implement that. But I can see that happening with Tyler Buckner, especially as decisive as he looked on the keeper in the red zone.
DOC Irish, what's one thing you think you know coming out of spring that might prove wrong when you get to see fall practice in person?
This is where I wrote down MTA and Keys as maybe jumping the gun a little bit in the spring. I also think the notion that, and I realize you have Michael Mayer at the head of the list at tight end. And so if you keep him on the field all the time, you're probably going to be pretty good. But I mean, the notion that Notre Dame's depth at tight end is just an absolute given going into the season. We didn't see Bauman this spring. We don't know for sure about George Takacs, although I think he'll be fine. I think for me, the first thing that popped in my head was that the tight end position is a given. When you think about the fact that you had Tremble and Wright on last year's team, and they were pretty dynamic in the roles that they played for the tight end core.
Nothing really comes to mind here. I'm not sure that there's anything that I would look at. I mean, maybe it will be the overwhelming force of the defensive line once Jared Patterson gets sorted into the offensive line. And then maybe what we see in fall won't look so much like what we saw in spring, where there are no long runs. The pocket collapses really quickly. But in some ways, I feel like I expect that to happen. So I don't. This is a hard one to answer. I don't think there's anything that jumps out to me and says, like, hey, this is something I'm really on guard for in the fall, just and what I saw in the spring might not match up.
I have one, since we didn't see practice, and he was named captain of the Blue Gold game. I'd like to see Houston Griffith with my own eyes do what got him to be named captain of the Blue Gold game.
And Shane Simon.
Yeah, although Simon, I guess when you make a nice little pick and a couple of blitzes, yeah. Shane Simon flashed. You know what I'm saying? That was more.
I'm lumping the two together in terms of consistent physicality.
Right. So that would be, you got to see fall practice to believe those things, right? You see 10 hours of practice, 9 hours of practice.
Yeah. Right. And we'll wrap up with a question from ND Alien. Who's the most famous person you've met at a Notre Dame event? Now, we've known a lot of famous Notre Dame people because of our just general coverage. About at an event, is there anything?
At a Notre Dame game in the old press box, I was in the same elevator as Muhammad Ali once.
That's a good one.
And then I think it was the night before Notre Dame played Syracuse at New Meadowlands or wherever that was. I went out to dinner with a Notre Dame alum, and we're seated next to Larry David. That was kind of cool. Not that I like interrupted him during dinner, but those are the two that jumped to mind to me.
Those are who you've seen. Who have you met?
Muhammad Ali, I just said like hello, but that, I don't know if that would qualify as a meeting.
You probably remembered it, Pete.
Sure. Yeah, I don't know if there's nobody was like, hey, in terms of meeting and getting to know somebody just because of Notre Dame, outside of Notre Dame, I didn't really have a good answer for that.
I mean, Muhammad Ali is about as famous as a human being you can get. So that's high on the list. I mean, I guess I have seen and been near or brushed up against Bon Jovi. He's pretty famous in terms of fame, right?
Yeah.
Like you may mention Bon Jovi to the world, he will pop up faster than, like, I saw Ernie Banks. I was kind of near Ernie Banks at the Chicago game in 2000 or the Miami game in Chicago in 2012, but Bon Jovi's known by more people than Ernie Banks, not to offend Priester on that one, but it's true. I don't know. That's a really good question. And I read it wrong because I read game and I'm trying to think of all the things we've seen. Vital is very famous, right?
Yeah. I just thought of somebody. Of course, I've been around for 100 years, so.
Joe Montana's awfully famous. I met him.
I've been around Joe Montana, but I was never introduced to him. I've told the story about, meeting Regis Philbin at Lou Holtz's home, actually, the week of the 93 Florida State game. I have a picture here interviewing Father Hesper. He's pretty famous.
He's on the Ali list of fame. Yes.
I knew Eric Parsegian, but like actual event. Okay, the two guys at actual Notre Dame events, Johnny Lattner, Heisman Trophy winner, and then Ross Browner, who was what did Lou Somogyi say about Ross Browner?
When they said his brother was going to be a better player than Ross Browner, that was the most offended I've seen.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah. Ross Browner is incredibly engaging. I met him at an event in Elmira, New York, and pretty much like kind of spent the weekend with him. And what a hoot he was, man. I mean, he was the life of the party.
we all met Bettis together. I mean, you knew Bettis, but afterwards, like, Bettis became famous after Notre Dame, and then we talked with him at Olympia Fields, remember, for one of the Kelly events?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a pretty famous – I mean, Muhammad Ali is more famous than Jerome Bettis.
I mean, for John Lattner, I remember when I met Rockne – no, that's not true. But I did meet John Lattner, one of Notre Dame's
– I mean, I met Montana. So Montana is probably the fifth most famous athlete you can name of the last
– What was
American the athlete of the last century.
What was the setting that you met him?
In South Bend at a bar, and he said, go Steelers, when we got done talking. It ruined me forever.
Really? You had a conversation. Oh, okay.
I had a conversation,
about the
49ers. Yes, he's and then I didn't say this, but the guy that was like eavesdropping on us when he was walking out said to Montana, "Go Niners," and he turned around and said, "Go Steelers." And I was like, because oh, I mean, that's his. You know, that was his team growing up. Maybe he went back to him. I don't know.
Yeah, I knew Moose Krause. I don't know necessarily that famous throughout the country these days, but. You cover Notre Dame for 40 years and you get an opportunity to meet a few pretty cool people. So, hey, that's it for our Irish Illustrated Insider podcast today. We appreciate you joining us. We'll be back next Monday, May 17th.
Thank you for listening to the Irish Illustrated Insider podcast. If you enjoy our coverage of Notre Dame football, please consider supporting the podcast with a small donation. Go to irishillustrated.com/support. Your support will help Irish Illustrated continue to be the leader in coverage of Notre Dame athletics.